The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Welcome! That's my best Dory Monson impression. Welcome to The Big Show. I've always wanted to do that, and I've been promised that I also get to do an hour number two echo today. This is Brandi Cruz filling in for my dear friend Dory Monson, who's under the weather today, after Nicole went through her entire Rolodex of who might be able to fill in for Dory.
Heck, number one.
I doubt that. She called me in a panic like 2 hours before the show, and I was in Seattle, and she said, can you fill in for Dory today? Anything for Nicole and anything for Dory. So this is like, since I'm an avid listener, it's like a dream of mine. So I'm going to do my best Dory Monson impression throughout the show. But I really am serious about the hour number two echo. I've been planning it. I've been plotting it, and it's going to be majestic, truly.
Okay.
So I'm very excited.
Something to look forward to.
Enough about me and my fangirling over Dory Monson, because we got a lot of news to get to. Let's get right to The Big Lead.
The Big Lead. Breaking news.
It was only a matter of time before the Omicron variant made its way to the United States. Honestly, it's probably already been here for some time, but now we're learning we have the first confirmed case of the Omicron. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. I've heard it pronounced a million different ways. We're going to call it Omicron.
I like it. Sounds close.
Down in California, there was a confirmed positive case of Omicron. And, you know, this is always interesting to me because I wonder how long it takes to figure out that that's the variant it is from the time that someone tests positive. So apparently it was 30 hours from the time that this person in California had a positive COVID test, and then all the genomic sequencing was done at the University of California in San Francisco, and then they confirmed the variant. So by that point, you know, you might have had this person, who knows how many people they had contact with. You know, there's a couple things about this, so we're not fear-mongering, because I think there's been a lot of fear-mongering in the press over this variant. First, let's just realize that variants of a virus are expected. This is to be expected. And so now we just have a new variant to contend with. And one of the things, the very important things that we know about this case in California, the individual was vaccinated, and they have very mild symptoms. Now, do they have mild symptoms because they have the vaccine? We don't know. Or do they have mild symptoms because Omicron is a mild variant? We've heard a lot of people, you know, in South Africa, for instance, who have had very mild symptoms from this. And if that's the case, then that's good news, right? The World Health Organization saying that they still need a little bit more information about not only this variant, but about this case.
It's still very early days in terms of our understanding of this variant, and we're grateful for the information that's coming in daily. There is the possibility, we don't have all the information yet on transmission in terms of if there is a fitness advantage, if it's more transmissible. There is some suggestion of that, but again, it's early days.
It's early days. And here's the thing, and this is where the media has just, you know, they like to, I think the press, some in the press, I won't say all of them, they like to just throw out the worst case scenario. You know, I saw this headline, Omicron could be 500 times more dangerous than the Delta variant. All these possibilities, like their job is to just plant anxiety in people's brains. And so, you know, is a new variant concerning? Of course it is. But there are still some really key things that we have no idea. We don't know if the current vaccines can help fight the variant or if it's immune to them. That would be significant. We don't know if it's more transmissible. We don't know if it's more dangerous or more deadly. So these are all things that we still need to figure out. And also, you know, we talk about this first case, and you're going to see a lot of headlines, a lot of breaking news banners. First case in the U.S., probably not the first case. This is the first detected case. I am sure that there are other instances of it that just have not been identified. The president saying that people shouldn't panic, and he is urging people who are not vaccinated to get the vaccine.
As I said, this new variant is a cause for concern, but not a cause for panic. We have the best vaccines in the world, the best medicines, the best scientists. We're learning more every single day.
And the president also teasing ahead to an announcement that he has scheduled for tomorrow.
Tomorrow, I'll be putting forward the next steps we'll be taking to fight COVID this winter, not with shutdowns or lockdowns, but with more widespread vaccinations, boosters, testing, and more.
It'll be interesting because I don't know how I feel about the president promising. First of all, when the president says no lockdowns or shutdowns, that's not really entirely up to him. I mean, governors can do whatever they want. They don't need the president's permission to do a lockdown. And so, you know, the president, is he going to do a national lockdown? Probably not. But, you know, if Americans are listening to that, they're going to be like, oh, great, no lockdowns. And then you're living in California or Washington or something, and the governors could do something completely different. And so I'm not sure how I feel about him saying that. And it'll be interesting to see what he has to announce tomorrow. And I know that there's been some talk, we're going to get to this later on in the show, about possibly having people quarantine when they return to the United States from other countries and what enforcement of that might look like. So we'll see what happens there. We'll stay tuned for the president's announcement. Obviously, if it comes during the show tomorrow, we anticipate that Dory would want to take that live to see what the president has to say about what the holidays are going to look like. So again, breaking news, the first confirmed case of the Omicron variant now in the United States, in California. The person is vaccinated. They're having very mild symptoms. And of course, there's still a ton more information that we need to know, Nicole.
What do you think about, I have a feeling that boosters is going to be part of the fully vaccination requirement.
I don't see how it couldn't. It seems like everything's been going toward that. And, you know, in fact, one of the things that was brought up and asked of Dr. Anthony Fauci today when they were announcing this new Omicron case is the media wanted to know, well, did the person have a booster shot? And he said, to the best of his knowledge, no. And we don't even know, you know, if the vaccine or a booster would have prevented this person from getting this variant. So I don't know if that's what the president's going to announce tomorrow, but it seems like that's inevitable at this point. Mm-hmm. And even if you just look at our state, it seems like when the governor has a mandate down for people to be vaccinated state workers, that would include getting a booster shot when the time is appropriate. So we'll stay tuned.
I think there's going to be a lot of pushback to that. I think people are going to have issues.
Well, you're going to start to see a chipping away, right?
Yes.
You had a lot of state workers who were fine with the first, you know, the two-dose regimen or the one-dose regimen.
Or not fine,
or whatever,
and did
they
it anyway.
Well, you had a lot who were like, I had to choose between my job and getting a vaccine. And I believe that as more and more mandates come down related to vaccines, you know, you got to get one booster, two boosters, three boosters. There's going to be a trickle of people who along the way say enough is enough. I'm not willing to do that. And we're, in fact, going to talk about the continuing impact of that vaccine mandate.
The Big Lead, top story.
This is not a surprise to anyone who has been paying attention. 911 call centers are short-staffed. There's a variety of reasons for that, but of course, one of them is because of the vaccine mandate. I have personally spoken to several 911 operators who lost their job over the vaccine mandate in our state. I was at a charity fundraising event where there was a woman just devastated over losing her job. Nicole, you were actually there with me, and this woman came up to speak to us. And so, you know, we know that this has happened. And, you know, you have this kind of perfect storm. And by perfect storm, I mean completely imperfect storm, where you've got low police staffing, and then you've got low staffing in 911 call centers, and they're just trying to hold it together at a time of rising crime. And you can imagine how difficult the situation is. Our friend Joel Moreno over at Como News did a report on the staffing shortages at local 911 call centers and at SPD.
Interim Director Chris Lombard says more than half these positions are currently vacant.
We were not able to hire and train as fast as we were losing people all summer long.
On average, Seattle's 911 center picks up incoming calls within 11 seconds. But 5% of all calls can take more than 40 seconds just to hear a dispatcher's voice.
So we unfortunately are at the point where there are many times during any given day where we just can't get to it.
In life or death situations where every second counts, these delays may only make matters worse. And the problems are magnified by the Seattle Police Department's own staffing shortages.
You know, we may have taken the call. We just may not have any officers to assign to the call.
Mayor Jenny Durkan proposed and the city council approved incentives to get more dispatchers to apply. But training the new hires will take months. In the interim, the Communication Center is focusing on handling calls that need an immediate response, even if it comes at the expense of other urgent calls for assistance.
So we try to find the most critical, the life safety type events, and push those to the top of the list to get officers. Unfortunately, what that means is that a lot of your lower priority calls just don't get answered.
And look, I've called 911 a couple times. I can tell you I've never called 911 when I didn't feel like it was an urgent emergency situation that I needed a police officer for. So to hear that some people are having to wait 40 seconds to even hear a dispatcher's voice when you're in an emergency situation, 40 seconds feels like 40 minutes.
Absolutely. That's scary.
And you have this, I talked a lot about this at the time of the vaccine mandate, and it's something that I grilled Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin about. It's this push and pull between two emergency situations, a health emergency and a public safety emergency. And I think there's a part of me that can understand the need to take drastic measures in the middle of an unprecedented health situation. But are you going to do that at the expense of public safety? You know, for instance, with officers, you know, they've been out there doing their job for 18 months in personal protective equipment. We didn't hear of any cases of transmission from an officer to the public, from firefighters to the public. They were out there doing their jobs. The only case I heard, and according to the Seattle fire chief, is a transmission from a community member to a firefighter. And so you have this situation where you're fearful about the possibility that police officers or firefighters or EMS interacting with members of the public could give them COVID. But then you're faced with a very real situation of people becoming victims of violent crime, needing a police officer to be there as fast as possible, where, as Joel Moreno pointed out, seconds matter. Seconds matter when you call 911. Seconds matter when you're bleeding out on a sidewalk from a gunshot wound and you need EMS and police to get to you as fast as possible. So I guess I don't understand putting one health emergency over a public safety emergency. And how could you not have found a way, realizing the impact that this was going to have on 911 call centers, on the police force during a time of rising crime, how could you not have found a way to keep these people in the mix to be helping with the drastic public safety situation that we have on our streets? I still can't. I can't quite wrap my mind around that.
The unwillingness to accommodate is the mind-boggling thing to me, because the rest of the state outside of King County, they've all made accommodations for people that didn't want to get vaxxed for or couldn't get vaxxed for whatever reason. But here, the zero accommodation thing doesn't make sense to me. And you can compare it to all of the other departments across the state that have made accommodations for people that couldn't get vaxxed or didn't want to get vaxxed. And you're not seeing COVID run rampant in those communities. So it just seems like stubbornness, and
it's like an all or nothing mentality. And you cannot tell me in a 911 center where they're in an office setting, we're in an office setting right now, I feel pretty safe here, there's, you know, plexiglass up or whatever. You cannot tell me that in an office setting like a 911 response center, you know, Joel Moreno said in his story that in this 911 response center, there's empty chairs everywhere because there's no one in there. You cannot tell me that you can't spread these people out. And even if you got to take officers off the street, put them in the 911 call center until you can figure out a different scenario for them. You know, at least keep them employed, because maybe the pandemic changes, things become less serious, and you can put them back out on the street. So there's a lot to this that you're looking at the impacts of a hasty decision in the interest of public health that is really having a drastic impact on public safety. And it is certainly not the only one. I want to go down to California. California is experiencing, much like Washington and other states, an uptick in violence. And the very liberal mayor of Oakland, California, has had enough. Libby Schaaf, who's a Democrat, said she is absolutely disgusted by the uptick in shootings and in homicides that her city is seeing.
The unacceptable and tragic loss of life, especially of innocent children, good Samaritans, and people who had dedicated their professional careers to keeping others safe, as well as supporting a free press.
Yeah, we had that tragic incident down in California of the security guard that was shot and killed protecting a news crew. And that's horrifying. You know, I know from experience out here when we go out with security, I mean, my security guard is the one who disarmed those rioters of stolen rifles, could easily have lost his life doing that. And so I think that's what she was alluding to at the end there. And good for her, honestly. You know, I know that probably a little too late for her to speak out about that, but to say, look, this is something we can all agree on. The violence is absolutely unacceptable. And she blames, in large part, the defund the police movement.
There is nothing progressive about unbridled gun violence. This is what Oaklanders want, a comprehensive and effective approach to safety, and that includes adequate police staffing.
She also talked about bail reform, and this is an issue that, of course, has been brought up after the Christmas parade attack in Wisconsin, where you've got this guy who's a career criminal accused of hitting his you know, ex-girlfriend or estranged girlfriend with a vehicle and a number of other charges, and then bonds himself out for $1,000 and then ends up killing people, including elderly individuals and children. And so there's this national conversation right now around bail reform. And the mayor in Oakland, again, the liberal mayor, is saying, look, you know, we need to make sure that people who are using guns to commit crimes are held accountable and can't easily get out of jail. And this is another thing that, you know, we can tie back to what's happening locally. It is always interesting to see. I did this big public disclosure request once where I looked at all the cases here involving gun crimes. And you would not believe how many of the people charged end up getting deals. And they end up getting sweet deals, less time. And it's probably just to get cases through the system. But here you have a political, you know, voice in Seattle where they're obviously very anti-guns, anti-gun violence, yet they're letting people who use guns to commit violent crimes plead down charges. And I think that's what the mayor of Oakland is getting at there, which is, you know, none of us support gun violence, yet these people who commit violent crimes on community members using firearms are just getting a slap on the wrist when it comes to bail. She's saying we need to do something about that. And council members in Oakland, in fact, seem to have her back, saying we need to have stricter laws.
When we talk about repeat offenses, these are things that we have to really make sense of in a way that helps to provide the carrot and the stick, if you would, that allows us to move towards a safer community.
Those who are committing crime realize there's...
Yeah, and so, you know, I wish that we had, it sounds like in Oakland, they're at least having some sort of agreement between the mayor and council members about, okay, things have hit a critical mass here. Innocent people are getting killed. And there's nothing woke about defunding the police, about lenient bail, about lenient prosecution when it's resulting in our citizens dying. So at least there seems to be that moment in Oakland where they're realizing this, where there's some political will to change course. I do wonder whether there's going to be a similar political will in our area, not only in Seattle, in outlying areas as well. In fact, let's go down for a moment to Federal Way.
The Big Lead, Big Local.
Another shooting in Federal Way. We'll fit this story in quick here in the Big Lead. Another shooting in Federal Way leaves two victims clinging to life. It happened at an ARCO station. And later on today, what time, Nicole, are we having Mayor Jim Farrell on?
1:30.
Later on today, we're going to have 1:30 Jim Farrell, the mayor of Federal Way, on to talk about his effort to build a coalition of leaders outside the city of Seattle who are fed up with the violence in their communities and want to make a change.
It's critically important that we speak as a cohesive group in South King County that has been hard hit by this violence. When they show up at the legislative session next year, they need to fix these drug laws. They need to fix these pursuit laws.
So Mayor Jim Farrell coming up at 1:30 to talk about this coalition they're building. Coming up next, we're going to have a little fun at the expense of Sound Transit. Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. This is Brandi Cruz filling in for my friend Dory Monson, who's a little under the weather today. So I was happy to stop by, hang out with my dear friend Nicole, and talk a little bit about the news. Now, I know when this Sound Transit story broke over the weekend, so you guys probably know the story by now. Apple Cup, you got fans leaving the stadium. Their buzz is wearing off. Well, maybe some of them, their buzz isn't wearing off yet. I don't know how drunk fans get. At the stadium, probably pretty drunk if I'm bringing back to my college days. You got them, some of them are dejected, sad. They've lost to the Cougs, and they just want to get home, you know? They did the responsible thing. They left their keys at home, and they just wander aimlessly over to the new light rail station, the one that has been celebrated so fondly by our local politicians. And here they are in the tunnel, you know, just going home to cry themselves to sleep over their loss. And all of a sudden, the train jerks to a stop. And these fans are left literally in the dark. For the better part of a half hour, a little over a half hour, have no clue what has happened to their train and what's going on in the tunnel. No communication for these fans. From the accounts that I've heard, it's getting sweaty down there. It's getting hot in the train car. I'm sure people smell, you know, they've been, you know, they were cold outside. Now they're all bundled up and sweaty underground. Some of them are having anxiety attacks. And so a few of the fans decide to, as you know, venture out into the unknown realms of the tunnel because they don't know if help is coming.
And when you got to go, especially
when you
after
gotta
you've
go.
Been drinking at the stadium.
God, I didn't even think about that. Ugh. I didn't even think about that. I got to go all the time. So, yeah. In fact, I just had a latte. Thanks, Nicole, for the latte. And I'll probably have to take a break soon. But so this story popped up on, well, we didn't really know anything about it until Saturday, unless you were following the happenings live on Twitter, which these a lot of them had cell service. And they're tweeting out these pictures in real time of what's going on in this video. But Sound Transit took 13 hours to come out and explain to the public what the heck happened. So I knew as soon as I heard that it was a Sound Transit story that Dory was going to be all over it. I said, Dory's probably at home plotting what he's going to talk about the Sound Transit debacle. I was also at home plotting what I was going to talk about. It's something I covered on my new digital show, Undivided, on Sunday. And, you know, my kind of take on this whole situation was, is it serious for, you know, trains to come dislodged from the main car underground and be sitting there for half hour? Of course that's serious. That's really scary for passengers to not have any communication about what's going on. But then I got to thinking, you know, Sound Transit bumbled this situation so poorly. And I thought, what if it had been worse? I mean, unfortunately, mass transit is a target for terror attacks. We don't like to think about that, but you have to plan for everything. What if it had been a mass casualty situation? Heck, what if it had been a natural disaster, like you got an earthquake or something? And so now I'm sitting at home terrified. Like, is Sound Transit even prepared for something serious when they can't even get some tipsy football fans out of a tunnel in 40 minutes? And so the other, I have this pet peeve, and it will forever be my pet peeve, about just really terrible publicly paid spokespeople. You know, people who are getting the big fat taxpayer check and can't be bothered to respond to calls from the media or act like we're annoying them by requesting comment on something, or who play obstructionist. That's the worst. Like, we're paying you to play obstructionist. Isn't your job to provide information to the public, especially when their title is public information officer, and then you can't get lick out of them? So Sound Transit, when they waited 13 hours to tell the public what happened, put out the worst series of tweets about this, absent any self-awareness whatsoever. So they put out 9:53 a.m. on Saturday, after this had happened Friday night, basically said, we had a significant issue last night with the Link light rail. Oh, you don't say. The whole internet knows you had a significant issue. Everyone but you seems to have said something about it. And they go on to say Sound Transit is investigating this. They talk about what happened. They don't talk about why it happened. They say a Link light rail train became disabled in the northbound tunnel after the electronic cable linking the first car and the trailing three cars was severed. We still don't know how it was severed. That seems like a pretty serious thing to understand. They just pass by that in their statement. This is my favorite, and by favorite, I mean least favorite part of this statement. With the severed cable preventing the operator from communicating by intercom with passengers in the trailing three cars, an unsafe incident developed when passengers decided to use emergency exits to leave the train. Like, that's the moment that the unsafe incident developed, is when passengers decided to leave the train. It's not when the train jerked to a stop underground, throwing them from their seats, and then they sat in a hot, sweaty car in the middle of a pandemic underground. That's not, I love the blame of the passengers for all of this. So Sound Transit went on to say, hey, we're going to look into this and see what happened and work on our safety protocols. And so I did this segment on Sunday, and I was surprised. I got a response from Sound Transit, and the tone was a little bit different. I think they realized that their tone on Saturday was horrible. And look, I don't know. It was, wasn't that the day after Thanksgiving? 2 days? Yeah, that was Thanksgiving weekend. I lose track of time.
Friday
so
is Apple Cup, yeah.
Right, and so maybe, who knows? I'm trying to give them the benefit of the doubt and say maybe this was like an intern tasked with monitoring social media over the weekend. But I'm sorry, you have what's going to be one of the busiest travel days for Sound Transit after the Apple Cup. That should be all hands on deck. So I don't know who wrote the Twitter statement, right?
But it was a holiday weekend.
Right, so holiday weekend. I don't know who wrote the Twitter statement that was horrendous, but Sound Transit was doing a little mea culpa work on Sunday and Monday, and it continues to happen. They responded to my segment and said, "We agree that the communications lapses on many levels Friday night are unacceptable and will be fixed." So that's good, right? They're not offering any sort of conditional statements on that. They're just saying unacceptable. And then people started to comment about, you know, their anger, and Sound Transit continued to respond and said, agreed, we're going to get to the roots of what happened, how to do better. So, okay, you know, they've changed their tune a little bit, but we still need to know what happened and need to know and be assured that Sound Transit can deal with a real emergency. I mean, if it's something that is a mass casualty situation. So just the fact that this happened, I wonder, one of the things I said on my show Sunday is, I can't tell you how many press releases and tweets and stuff I saw about the artwork that Sound Transit was installing at its stations. Like, I really hope that they've spent more time planning for how to respond to an emergency than what artwork was going to go up at its new facilities, because something tells me maybe they didn't. So I look forward to hearing what Sound Transit finds out from this investigation that it conducted. All right, coming up after the break, Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of Transportation, and if you believe the gossip columns, perhaps the next vice presidential candidate of the United States, has a message for those of you who are angry about the cost of gas. That's next. Realize it was disco day on the Dory Monson show. Is that disco music? I suppose I wasn't alive in the 70s.
It's close.
It's a disco vibe to
it. It's disco vibe. Disco vibe is always good.
I just don't want to play. I told Dory this the other day when I was on with them. I don't want to play the game where I have to guess music. That is not my strength. So I won't be ever playing that game with Dory.
Okay, good
so
to know.
So not interested in doing that at all. I got an admission to make, and Nicole was just looking at the text line. She's like, oh, people are being very nice to you. Not after I say this. I was a huge Pete Buttigieg fan when he was running for president.
Early on, right?
Early on. Mm-hmm. Incredibly intelligent. And I like the fact that he's like, oh, I don't need to, you know, work my way up the ranks. I want to be president. I'm going to run for president. He goes from this, like, mayor of a mid-sized town. And I liked the coolness of that, right? And I appreciate someone who is incredibly well-spoken, doesn't need a lot of research because they actually are caught up and they know about the topics that they're speaking about. And you can really tell the difference between, I thought, Pete Buttigieg and other candidates like Jay Inslee, for instance, who felt like they were sort of making things up as they went along. So I had a lot of admiration for Pete Buttigieg. He said something today, though, that, gosh, Pete, why you do me like this, Pete? Now I can't defend you over this. So, of course, if this is breaking news to you, maybe the cost of gas is quite high. I haven't, you know, I got lucky because I quit my job, as you guys know. I don't know if that's lucky, but I've definitely saved on gas because I don't have to drive in from East King County every single day into Seattle. But gas is expensive, and I'm not breaking that news to any of you. And this is a real concern for Americans, and I think this is sometimes where politicians and the press lose sight of the actual concerns of everyday Americans and what kind of things are really busting their budget and really a worry for them. You know, I remember a point in my life where I grew up in a poor family. I struggled a lot through college financially and tried my first big job in New York City. And I remember those moments standing by the gas pump being like, I'm going to put $3 in because that's all I have. And that was when I didn't have a family to care for. So when you have a family, you have bills, you have all these competing interests. The cost of gas is incredibly consequential for people's lives. And so I don't like to hear anyone dismiss it or anyone, you know, make fun of it or make light of it. So Pete Buttigieg was doing an interview with The Hill, and he had some advice for Americans who are concerned about the price of gas.
But there is more envisioned in the Build Back Better law. I'll give you one example. It contains incentives to make it more affordable to buy an electric vehicle, up to a $12,500 discount, in effect, for families thinking about getting an EV. Families that once they own that electric vehicle will never have to worry about gas prices again.
So if you can afford an electric vehicle, you'll never have to worry about gas prices.
You wonder what's circulating up there in the old noggin to put that sentence together and let it come out of your mouth. A couple issues with that, obviously. Buying an electric car is not a solution for the nation's gas prices, number one. I mean, that's an easy deflection for what the country is dealing with as opposed to trying to address it head on. In most cases, in many cases, electric cars are very expensive. And if you're an American who's struggling to pay for gasoline, something tells me, maybe I'm, you know, not quite as out of touch as Pete Buttigieg, something tells me that at the top of your mind is not buying a new vehicle. And also, you know, electric vehicles are costlier to repair as well. And so it just reeks of this out-of-touch mentality to deflect from the real problem, which is rising gas prices, and to present a completely out-of-touch solution to everyday Americans who have this profound issue that's impacting their lives. And your response is to tell them to go buy a new car. Pete, you let me down. If he does, there was these rumors, and I don't know if we're going to get to this other story. We might have to kick it down the road a little bit later. There was this cut from President Biden that is of the same vein. But, you know, there was this rumor, I believe it was in the Telegraph out of London, that they literally just printed a rumor. It was like, and even they said it's probably not true, but even the fact that it's a rumor is significant. There's this rumor that Democrats are thinking of just wiping the slate clean in 2024. And President Biden's, you know, he's getting up there in age. He's probably not going to run again. I think everybody knows that. And then there, Kamala Harris has a really low approval rating. And so the Independent was just tossing out the scenario where Dems get rid of Kamala Harris by having her appointed to the Supreme Court. And then they bring in Pete Buttigieg to run with someone else. Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete, sweet, sweet Mayor Pete. This line is going to haunt you if you run on the 2024 campaign trail. Let's actually get quickly to this Biden soundbite, which is in a similar vein. So the president is trying to reassure Americans about the supply chain issues, obviously going into the holidays. This is a concern for all of us. You want your presents to get there on time and all of that. And he's doing this speech and he's talking about, oh, I've talked to the CEOs of companies and I've talked to big retailers and delivery companies, and none of them are concerned. They all say the shelves are stocked and it's not a problem for the holidays.
You know, it's interesting because I was just in Disney World and we went to get an ornament that like said Disney, you know, Christmas 2021, and there were none. And I asked why, and she said it's because of the supply chain. And in fact, they just got their Halloween stuff in last week, so they weren't going to get it until after Christmas, they're pretty sure. So I don't quite believe what he's saying there, that no one's concerned about it, because it's already happening.
Yeah, he's citing all these companies and CEOs he talked to, and they're just chipper, and they don't see any issues. And I will say, my dog had an accident in my car the other day, and the worst of the two kinds of accidents, if you know what I'm saying.
It was bad.
And the cleaner at the store was, like, sold out. So I was in my moment of crisis and had nothing to get rid of the smell. You had to ride in my car.
I did, after it was clean, but I still smelled the hit.
Really got off on a tangent. But here's President Biden reassuring the kiddos of America that, for the most part, they should be able to get what they want for Christmas, with a few exceptions.
Now, I can't promise that every person will get every gift they want on time. Only Santa Claus can keep that promise. But there are items every year that sell out that are hard to find. Some of you moms and dads may remember Cabbage Patch Kids back in the 80s, or Beanie Babies in the 90s, or other toys that have run out at Christmas time in past years when there was no supply chain problem. But we're heading into a holiday season in very strong shape.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Cabbage Patch
Kids. Beanie Babies, I guess.
Tickle Me Elmo, remember that?
Yeah, I mean, so the President's saying basically, if your favorite toy isn't under the tree, don't blame me. You can either blame Santa Claus, or you can blame the fact that they're so popular. And other parents, a.k.a. Santa Claus, got the gift before you did. So that gem, ladies and gentlemen, from the President of the United States, you can pass that along to your kids. All right, coming up in the next hour, a proposal to have some thought behind how to clear homeless encampments gets shot down by a city council. We'll discuss that and much more coming up.